From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's hard enough to eat well and stay in shape, but in several parts of Georgia, residents don't have access to nutritious foods. The Georgia Farmers Market Association is actively trying to change that. Its initiatives connect small growers with communities that don't have good options to buy fresh, high-quality produce. And to get the word out about issues of equity, the association is launching Just Food Weekend. Sedrina Brown-Jalal is executive director of the Georgia Farmers Market Association, joining me now in the studio. Welcome, Sedrina.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Also here is Elijah Lee, perhaps better known as Chef Zhu. He's a sustainable plant-based chef and founder of King's Apron. Chef Zhu, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sedrina, agriculture, one of the biggest industries in Georgia. You know, we have national rankings right at the top for blueberries, pecans, peanuts, poultry, and of course, we're called the Peach State. So why do people here lack access to nutritious foods?
So one of the things that we consider often within the Georgia Farmers Market Association is that, you know, that irony that we are such a large agriculture state. I think the thing to keep in mind is that 80% of the food that we actually consume in our state comes from outside of Georgia. So, you know, there's clearly a need for us to emphasize where local growers are and to improve access to those growers through farmers markets, direct purchases from farm stands and CSAs and those types of things.
So how bad is the problem? How many people or places in Georgia don't have access to fresh produce?
You know, those figures change a lot, but what we do know is that one in six Georgians are food insecure. And one in four Georgia children also lack access to good quality nutritious food in our state.
And Chef Zhu, is this something that you have seen in your work in mostly underserved communities and programs helping people to make food?
Definitely.
So what do you do? What does King's Apron do to help?
Well, we focus on about 60% of our efforts are like food programming, educational food programming.
So you go into schools and that kind of thing?
Schools, different nonprofits, homeless shelters, senior citizens' homes, churches. We've been to mosques before. So, you know, we're really just involved with the community on a grassroots level and trying to teach them healthy eating alternatives and techniques by using as many local produce, you know, in that process.
And you also make food with them? Is that part of the thing, is your role as a chef?
Totally. Yeah.
So the farmers market is calling this Just Food Weekend. Why, Sedrina, framing it as an issue of justice?
That's a really good question. We realize that there are kind of two audiences that we want to pay particular attention to, and that's the farmer and the consumer. And one of the things that is wonderful about farmers markets is where all of the aspects of local food come together. And we know that small-scale farmers don't have the same incentives or subsidies as industrial farms to be able to grow food. So there's a need to educate consumers on the fact that that is a challenge for the folks that are growing the food that we eat. And then, you know, we have in Georgia a history of racism in the food system. We have a history of land loss in our state with black farmers. And so just kind of paying attention to those just very real experiences for farmers in our state and bringing attention to it, raising awareness is really important.
Yeah, and access, of course, is a big question here. Food insecurity is a term that often people associate with poverty. So someone could live near a supermarket but not have money to buy nutritious foods there. The USDA definition is more broad. Food insecurity means food access problems or limitations. So why do you think, Sedrina, important to consider both factors, affordability and actually distance?
Absolutely. Well, and I do want to point out that it's really important to consider that not only are people people that are experiencing poverty have limited access to food, but also those that don't fall into the federal guidelines around poverty. So the access issue and the affordability issue is actually even greater than we might consider. But yes, it is a problem. We have, you know, seniors that have limited mobility, that lack access to fresh food, in addition to low-income families. In rural communities, there could be many, many miles between grocery stores. And so it really does create a significant issue for families when it comes to getting access to fresh food. And even in urban communities where there may be corner stores, but the fresh food is not present in those spaces.
Yeah, and we could pull that thread out even further. A household can be food insecure if it can't get nutritious food, could be low-income family again. But it's also communities, full communities are considered food insecure. Is that just about access for the most part?
I think it's about access, but again, it goes back to equity. You know, it really kind of depends on it. Some people have access, others do not. So how do we make sure that the access to the food is fair across the board and reaches a cross section of the community is what we kind of ask ourselves.
Chef Zhu, your organization, King's Apron, is based in Atlanta. What parts of the metro area do you see facing food insecurity?
Well, I mean, it's all through Atlanta, but, you know, once again, it's the low-income communities on each side of the city. Mm-hmm. So you have nestled communities within the east side or Decatur, but then within Decatur, you have, like, Belvedere Park. That's a low-income community. You know, the access to the food is there via Kroger, but other than that, you know, you don't have many options, you know, so...
We're speaking with Chef Zhu, a holistic nutritionist, founder of King's Apron. He's a sustainable plant-based chef. And Sedrina Brown-Jalal, executive director of the Georgia Farmers Market Association. Well, let's talk about not having a car. This is about access and not having a grocery nearby. A few months ago, Samantha Max from the Macon Telegraph set out to buy food. And here's an excerpt from her story about it.
See, we've got a gas station right here. Hi, candy, beef jerky. I'll write that down as some form of protein. But I only found two items on my grocery list, and both were more expensive than at Kroger. This is on our list. So I headed over to the Family Dollar across the street. Candy, plenty of different pastries. Oh, peanut butter. That's a good thing for the list, actually.
You can hear from that story that local grocery mart that she goes to really does matter. But chains won't open a store in an area without what they determine to be a reliable customer base. What is it that prevents smaller, privately owned grocery stores from setting up shop?
I think that just the nature of produce, if we're talking about access to to fresh food, the nature of produce is that it has an expiration date. And so it can be hard to keep those things stocked and to make sure that that customers are purchasing at a level so that food doesn't go bad and that there's not loss of revenue from the food. So I think that's one of the major issues. I know in my community, there was just a new grocery store, a little corner store that opened up. And in the beginning, they had produce, and then it sat on the shelf. And eventually, there was no more produce there.
So you think it sat on the shelf because it was too expensive? People weren't used to shopping for produce there?
I think it's both. I think that just like she mentioned on the segment there, it is more expensive oftentimes at the smaller stores than it is at larger retailers. And then also, I think we are disconnected from our food, from the land in many ways and how it's grown. And that disconnection has meant that a lot of people are not cooking as much anymore and are unfamiliar with ways to create dishes and menu items for their families using local fresh produce.
Mm. And part of the USDA's definition about food insecurity, or let's say commenters on it, is that it has to be safe, culturally acceptable place to buy mm-hmm. food. How did these factors come into play?
You know, it's interesting. We've been paying a lot of attention to what's happening with local food in communities and how, you know, whether or not what we're seeing is culturally relevant. And I think it's a big part of it. I mean, if you are accustomed to eating food that connects to your culture and you go to a store and you can't find those items, then that creates another layer of challenge, which then becomes a barrier.
Mm. Well, farmers market, of course, help. Farmers markets, part of what you're doing is trying to provide access to local fresh food, but cost certainly a concern. I went to a farmer's market this weekend. I paid $5 for a small bunch of carrots and $3 for parsley. Obviously, I'm supporting a local farmer. I'm there at the market, which is something that I believe in. But how do you make sure that farmers paid decently for their work and the food is affordable?
So one of the wonderful programs that we have at Georgia Farmers Markets is the Wholesome Wave Georgia program, where they offer incentives for families that are food insecure and also are able to access SNAP EBT benefits. Those families at participating Wholesome Wave markets in our state are able to use their SNAP benefits and get twice as much value for the food. So if they swipe their card for $10, then they are able to shop for $20 worth of fresh produce. So that's one of the things that we've done to increase access. We also, at Georgia Farmers Market Association, we've started a sliding scale CSA hybrid farmers market model that addresses food access on more of a scale, which increases the access for a lot of families that are experiencing it and may not actually have access to SNAP benefits.
Do you know what percentage of sales in farmers markets altogether generally come from SNAP or EBT sales?
It varies significantly from community to community. I know one of my farmers actually told me that 30% of his sales last year came from SNAP sales. So that's pretty significant. And that particular farmer is at several different farmers markets in the metro Atlanta area. But that does give you kind of an idea of what's possible for farmers and also how we can improve access by increasing SNAP shopping at farmers markets.
According to the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, Georgia ranks 41st among states in overall health. Chef Zhu, you're also a holistic nutritionist. So why do you think that is? How does access to healthy food play into this?
Well, yeah, I believe that, you know, for me, when I'm thinking about it, it's first of all, it's the learning that we need to get to, right? So you have like less ability to learn and then less ability to generate money. And the combination of those two puts you in a really sticky situation, you know? So I think...
You mean less ability to learn if you're not adequately, you don't have adequate nutrition?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you don't have the vitamins and the minerals to go to the brain. So for instance, selenium found in nuts would be considered a brain food. So one, if you don't have the education to know that, but two, if you don't have the money to afford it, and then it might be too far to get, so you lack the selenium, which would actually help build the brain up to think a little bit more on whatever level, mm-hmm. right? Whether that's thinking better at your job, whether that's thinking better for your family, whether that's thinking better on how to build your business. So I think, you know, that's sometimes overlooked, that the ability to think and learn is, you know, one of the number one key things that we need to be paying attention to when we talk about, you know, food insecurity in low-income communities.
Well, we're going to put a hold on this conversation for just a moment. Chef Zhu, he is the founder of King's Apron. Sedrina Brown-Jalal, executive director of Georgia Farmers Markets. We'll get back to some of the solutions they're talking about after the break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're continuing our conversation about food access and justice. The Georgia Farmers Market Association is calling this Just Food Weekend. Sedrina Brown-Jalal, is the group's executive director, and she's here along with Elijah Lee, perhaps better known as Chef Zhu. He's founder of King's Apron and a sustainable plant-based chef. We talked a little bit before the break about access. Now let's turn about to what your organizations are doing to help. First, Sedrina, what is the goal of Food Justice Weekend?
So the goal really is to raise awareness and to engage people in the conversation around how we can increase local food access in communities across Georgia.
And Chef Zhu, how are you involved?
Yeah, so as she passes the baton in that manner, I'll try to focus on minimum required amounts of fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. Now that we have access to it, what are those minimum amounts? You know, 5 servings a day, preferably 3 vegetable, 2 fruit, but showing the community innovative, creative ways to make sure that you get these minimum amounts, right? New dishes, new recipes, and just trying to tie it into the community to get people to cook more, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and get people out of their kind of food ruts. I mean, it's easy to go and spend 99 cents at Taco Bell, right?
Exactly.
Right. So how do farmers markets enter into the food justice equation?
Well, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we have just amazing advocates that run our markets. Our market managers and their teams are always looking for creative ways to engage new shoppers and to raise awareness to the challenges that small-scale farmers face. A good bit of our farmers markets, our member markets, do outreach within the community to invite people to participate at the market, to make sure that families of all income levels have access to fresh food by offering the opportunity to use SNAP benefits. They also connect with other organizations that promote health and health through fresh fruits and vegetables and eating other nutrient-dense food to make sure that people are aware. Because some of the challenges really is just people knowing where to find local food and fresh food in their community. So our markets work really hard to engage with others.
So connecting small growers with communities that don't have ready access to fresh produce is one of the things that you do. What prevents that supply from getting there?
I think it's really just that farmers markets and farmers themselves, they're not really that focused on tooting their own horn. They're focused on growing the food. And so, you know, unlike major retailers or grocery stores where there's, you know, huge marketing budgets and campaigns around these kinds of things, markets typically just kind of appear. And so we're really trying at the Georgia Farmers Market Association to have more of a collective presentation of what markets are available in our state, what their hours of operation are, where they're located, what their season is, because it's markets are very seasonal. That's one of the beautiful things about shopping at a farmers market is that you do get to have the freshest food that's available in our state, but it's offered kind of seasonally. So making sure that people understand that it is a very different experience than shopping at the grocery store, but it is a powerful experience because you're able to speak directly with the person who's grown your food and to know exactly how it's been grown and how you can prepare it.
How about the sort of concrete steps about, you know, overcoming barriers to transportation, for example, or regulation? How are you involved in that?
So really interesting. We have a pilot program that we're doing with several organizations in the city. There's going to be a way that we are collectively addressing transportation through Lyft. We're still working on all the details, but that's really the city of Atlanta's sustainable agriculture focus is really developing that programming. And some of our markets even have transportation options and buddy systems, and they encourage a lot of creative ways for folks to get to the market. Some of our markets list MARTA routes to get to and from the farmers market. So we're definitely trying, but it's a challenge when you're working in open air spaces that are not necessarily convenient or have access to public transportation.
Right. Now, Chef Zhu, you've done this kind of food programming through a broad range of organizations. You mentioned some of them, local markets, high schools, nonprofits, even the Atlanta Housing Authority and Morehouse College. So what kind of feedback do you get from these kind of programs when you work with people and educate them about their access to or their options for food?
Yeah, most people, you know, love the idea that they can finally obtain that minimal required amount, right? So they're just happy that I'm getting more fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And then past that, I think they're excited, you know, to try something new at the same time. So, I mean, we have a lot of, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I mean, it's just like a lot of happy people when we come through.
Sadrina, a lot of people, especially in cities, consider farmers markets. They're fun. They're communal events. You bring the family, you bring the kids, the dog, you know, rather than a necessity. So how are you going to engage customers to see their local markets as primary sources of shopping and really as these vehicles for food justice?
Well, I mean, I think having chefs like Chef Zoo and even local chefs come and do food demonstrations, have tastings, and really create more experiences with the food at the market is key. When we start the beginning of each season, we host a food demonstration training for our market leaders. And in addition to making sure that we're sharing the nutritional value of the produce that's being focused on, we also want to make sure that we talk about things like how to store it, the benefits of purchasing it in bulk, and how to preserve it. We also talk about in our conversation, we want to make sure that the person who's doing the demonstration does address things like food insecurity and the importance of everyone supporting ways to increase access, mm-hmm. and also supporting our small farmers. So we use the food demonstration as an opportunity to create conversation and to raise awareness on really important issues in communities.
But how do you work beyond the communities that already come to the farmers market?
Absolutely. At that same training, we really encourage our leaders to identify other stakeholders in their community and other community-based organizations that can raise awareness both that the market's there, but also the programming that's there, the opportunity to connect with your neighbors. We also really encourage them to do food demonstrations and offer information beyond the market at those locations, and then, you know, partnering with churches and schools and things like that.
Sadrina Brown-Jalal, she's Executive Director of the Georgia Farmers Market Association. Thank you so much for being with us. And Chef Zhu, he's holistic nutritionist, founder of King's Apron, and a sustainable plant-based chef. Thank you both for taking the time today. Really appreciate it. And we're going to leave you with Neil Young's Harvest Moon. If you want to find more on Food Justice Weekend, which is probably hitting a farmer's market somewhere near you, you can go to our website, gpbnews.org. We're going to leave you with Harvest Moon. Why not? It's Neil Young. It's Growing Something. Kay Powell is not easily spooked. The veteran reporter and longtime obituaries editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is known as the doyen of the death beat. It is not the great beyond, she fears, but the great decline. Here's Kay from the episode that just came out of the 10 Things That Scare Me podcast.
Dealing with my steel trap mind turning into a sieve.
WNYC Studios invites people to expose their most scaredy cat selves for the podcast. Kay is joining me to talk about that experience, along with Daniel Guimet. He's producer on the line from WNYC. Welcome.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here today and talk about what scares me, one of which is not being your guest on your show.
Well, we can put an end to that one right here. So, Daniel, what are you trying to do with this podcast?
The show really, the episodes are really short, so they're about 5 minutes. So in a way, what we're trying to do is create something that's a little poetic. It's kind of meditative for people to just sort of be in the space of one person's brain. I guess the result that I usually get from it is I feel a lot of empathy for the people that I'm listening to, mm-hmm. whether or not I understand their perspective or they're coming from a completely different kind of world than I am. So.
And there are 10 things and they're in order. So, Kay, what was that exercise like for you? Could you call them right to mind, or did you have to really think about this?
Oh, I had to think about it. Not a lot scares me or I'm afraid of. And I kept emailing WNYC and saying, I can only come up with 4. All right, I've come up with 6. Do I really have to have 10? Okay. And just got broader and broader and less me-specific in the list.
But in the end, you came up with them. And your number one, tornado blowing a tree onto your house?
Yes.
And worse, having to get cut out of it.
I've seen this as a Red Cross disaster volunteer, and it's an image that you never can unsee. And I'm surrounded by trees. I've had a tree fall on my fence. I've had a tree fall on my deck. We had a tornado last night. I survived it. I'm here. So no tree last night.
Well, Danielle, some of the common ones we hear, you know, natural disasters certainly come up. Snakes, cancer, heights. Others seem more specific to the people that you ask. Here is Anthony Scaramucci, who spent, I don't know, 10 days as the White House communications director.
15 minutes, right. Yeah.
Returning to Washington. I was laughing at the president the other night where he was saying that he thought the real estate people in New York were animals until he got to Washington, D.C., and he realizes these people are a bunch of babies. I mean, they're just the worst people I've ever met in my life. I mean, these people do not serve the public interest. And there's a very good reason why the American people voted out levels of the establishment and brought in President Trump.
So not entirely surprising from him. His number one was divorce lawyer, but down the list, the mooch said he was also afraid he wouldn't have the influence or ability to communicate with his kids. So there's a kind of admission of vulnerability from a man known for his bravado. What do we get from that, Dan?
Well, two things. I think, again, it's kind of an empathy, which I think is really interesting. And I think it's more about people, it's getting at people in a way that can surprise you yourself, you know? And I think that, like, he was so open, and it was so wonderful talking to him about his experiences because of his willingness to be open about himself. And I think with Kay, too, I know, Kay, you said you were struggling at times, and it was always so funny because we were talking, you were like, I don't know if I can do the show. I don't know if I have enough stuff. But I think over time, you know, you kind of you said you got broader, but I think in a lot of times people kind of go deeper. And I think even with yours, Kay, that you some of the ones that you might think were broader, I feel like in there was something that really connects to who you are.
Yes,
or something deeper.
And thank you, Dan. I think they also are things that are residual in my brain. It's always there. It shapes my thinking on a lot of things and my reaction to a lot of things. I just had to pull it to the forefront.
Well, I'm thinking that fear is, of course, a part of the human condition. And in fact, our brains are wired to find fear, right? To create vigilance so we won't, you know, step into the quicksand or get bitten by the alligator or snake or whatever. But I'm guessing that you spend a lot of time kind of putting it to the side. Is that what happened for you, Kay, that you couldn't quite access this stuff?
I don't know, because I don't think of them in terms of fears or being scared. But you mentioned snakes. As a little girl, maybe five or so, I was walking across a neighbor's yard, and I saw a diamondback rattler. And something in me at that age even told me to stop and wait for it to pass. So I think we do have the flee fear,
the fight or flight
reaction, and it's so innate. But Dan, y'all made me come up with 10. So a good 10.
I loved it, Kate. It was so wonderful. And I think that in a lot of ways, I thought your fears were actually connected to each other in ways that you might be, that could be surprising. The tree blowing down and killing you in your bed, I thought actually could connect to some of the other ones, which was concerns about aging single. At the end, you had a whole thing about your will and what you'd be leaving behind to people. I felt like there was a kind of interesting tangle of stuff in a way that felt connected to each other. So I loved your list. But I will say that I often tell people, and I think I told you, Kay, that I tell people not to say snakes, heights, rats, spiders, because we got all those at the beginning.
Right.
And I realized that that was they could kind of be blockages to getting to something more interesting and more specific to people.
I should have asked you that, Daniel. What are your rules for this? What do you tell people?
Well, yeah, so I tell them those things that they cannot say. I will not take. I also include
anything
about. I
don't remember you giving me that list.
Well, maybe because you were struggling so hard to come up with some. I said, okay, I'll let Kay, whatever she wants. But I said, no airplanes. I have no flying, things like that. for the most part, I think for most people, there is something kind of really lodged in there, and getting to that spot is my goal every time I'm doing the interviews anyways.
Well, okay, let that be a lesson to everybody, because WNYC does invite people to submit their own fears to the 10 Things That Scare Us podcast. We're speaking with Daniel Guimet. He's producer of the podcast, and also with Kay Powell, the award-winning obituary editor and writer who shared her biggest fears. We're going to be back and hear more about that, but first, let's hear from some folks right around here at Georgia Public Broadcasting revealing what scares them.
Financial instability terrifies me because a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck, and that means like you're like a paycheck and a half or two paychecks away from legitimately being homeless. That's like terrifying.
If I see a bee and I hear its wings, you won't see me. I'm gone. I usually don't run, but I will run if I hear a bee nearby. Along with clowns, like, why is that entertaining to people? I don't get it. Don't have a clown at anyone's party.
I am terrified of the dentist. I don't want anyone working in my mouth. So they virtually have to tie me down to the chair. So I've now just revealed my most vulnerable phobia. And I really am hoping that no one is listening to this particular segment of On Second Thought.
Stay with us. There's more On Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're speaking about what scares us as human beings with the veteran reporter, longtime obituaries editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Kay Powell, and also with Daniel Guimet. He is the producer of the 10 Things That Scare Me podcast, little bite-sized bits of, you would say human terror, but there's also a lot of human empathy and feeling in these. I want to pick up, Kay, on what Daniel was just talking about. You know, you're a woman who spends a lot of time thinking about people's lives, writing about their deaths. But it's aspects of aging that are scary to you. Like what?
Well, will I have enough money for old age? Who will be there to take care of me? I really, really fear a stroke, dementia, Alzheimer's. Almost anything related to aging when you need support. I do have some wonderful older people in my life. I hate the term elderly. Okay. We're all older. We're all older than somebody. I don't know what the tipping point is for elderly, but I have a lot of older friends who are great role models, like little pathfinders, for me to watch how they cope, how they readjust, the workarounds they come up with. And I'm keeping all that filed away.
Well, I would love to hear about some of those folks, because you talk in your in the podcast about the women that you play bridge with. Who are they?
They are wonderful. I'm the baby of the group. And one day a phone rang, and the 93-year-old I was playing with reached inside her blouse and brassiere and pulled out her smartphone for a conversation. And I said, oh, my goodness, you are just like the young people in the clubs that carry their phones around in their bra. So they are, you know, they're hip. They're old, but they're hip. And that's what I want to do, Virginia. Workaround is exact. I want to keep doing those things I like doing, stay involved in the things I like to stay involved in. And rather than dropping them as my capacity diminishes, I want to find the new ways of doing what I've always liked doing. Mm.
Being a woman aging alone is one of the things that you mentioned specifically. And aloneness actually comes up quite a bit in the podcast. Here is Samin Nosrat. She's the Iranian-born food writer and author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
Yeah, I don't have a long... let's put it this way. My professional resume is much longer and more filled out than my personal one.
Samin Nosrat from the 10 Things That Scare Me podcast. Well, you know, a little embarrassment there. So, Kate, what is it like, Daniel, to hear people for the first time say these things out loud?
I mean, it's fascinating. I can't count the amount of people that have told me and my fellow producer, Amy, that it feels like therapy. And so, I, you know, I'm not paid as much as the therapist, but it's fine. But I do think that it's something people are surprised themselves at kind of what can come out. And it's really moving. And I feel like a responsibility when I'm hearing people be as open as they are to be careful and to be, when we're editing it, putting it together, to just be as honest and close to what they, you know, we're trying to get across, but also be extremely fair. And like I said, a real sense of responsibility, because I'm really appreciative, and the whole team is appreciative of how willing people are to open themselves up like this.
Kay, what did you find, though? Was it liberating, or does it somehow make you feel even more, you know, like once you admit something out loud, sometimes it becomes real?
No, I wouldn't say it was liberating. I wouldn't say I faced something for the first time in going through this thinking process. What I would say is what Daniel pointed out. It gave some continuity to it. It made me focus in and just say, okay, helter skelter, this is what has been scaring you. Let's pull it all together, think about it, and gosh, it's not as bad as I thought.
Some of them do sound slightly irrational. I'm not saying yours in particular, but as we're listening to others, like, you know, some of the folks that we heard from GPB. What do you think, Daniel? Does saying them out loud somehow, I don't know, inoculate people, because it doesn't sound quite as fearful out in the world as it does inside of your head?
I think it does a lot for the irrational ones, but the bigger, like, you know, for example, someone was afraid of one of my favorite episodes. Someone was afraid of like a subway in New York, the subway lid essentially flying up in the air as they're walking on top of it and shooting them into the sky. And so I think in that case, he was, you know, and he was worried that he would be the first person in history who died from, you know, one of those shooting him up in the air. But I think in a case like that, where they're very irrational, that's what happens. I don't know if it's the same way for the more existential ones. I think those are so present in people's lives. And like you said, a sense of aloneness, I think, carries across so many people in American society in particular. And so I can't imagine that once you're articulated that it's going to feel like it goes away.
Mm-hmm. I want to make it clear, I have a lot of wonderful, smart, and creative young friends, and they keep my mind sort of active also. And I joke that they're my feeder system as my older friends die off and become incapacitated. I have this feeder system of really young, creative, involved friends. So, and they're fun. I really enjoy them.
Well, actually, one of the things you do talk about is being remaining relevant, you know, as youth-obsessed culture, to feel like you are actually part of. And, you know, a lot of people do their communicating on social media. I found it interesting, Daniel, that John Ronson said he's afraid of Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wrote a whole book about Twitter, and so I think, and kind of public shaming. But he also has, like he said, so he can kind of see it objectively from the outside, and yet himself, he has such as it kind of comes across in the whole episode, a real sense of anxiety and sometimes even social anxiety. I don't want to speak for him too much, but, you know, so the idea of people commenting on him in his own life is terrifying. And I think it's something that a lot of people can relate to, but in a kind of broader sense. But I do think that for him, it's coming from a place of anxiety, a real deep anxiety. He talked about having panic attacks. He talked about one of his fears, which sounds maybe a little silly, was about saying the wrong thing at a dinner party. But then he tells a story about a woman who was telling him how she said the wrong thing at a dinner party to Elvis Costello and one of her idols. And it actually led her to a deep agoraphobia. She was so afraid of going out. And he says, it sounds, you know, kind of wild and kind of crazy, but he said it doesn't seem that far away from me at this point in my life. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, a deep read into people's minds and how they work. Samin Nusrat, who we mentioned before, she, the Iranian food writer, she also talked about her fear as a brown person living in America.
That the color of my skin will bring harm upon me. I've always been aware of being different, but I wasn't really aware of any sort of threat to my physical person because of the way I look until September 2001. at that time, I used to wear this agate necklace, and it had the Arabic names of like the five main prophets of Islam on there. And so I remember I got a flat tire a few days later, and the guy who was changing my tire was black. And he was like, oh, what's on your necklace? And I told him, and he's like, you got to put that away. It's not safe to look like you look anymore.
September 11th actually comes up a few times on people's list of scary things. Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama, also said she fears a domestic act of terrorism. Dan, did you hear a lot of that kind of things? You know, those that are looming large in our political and social realm, racism, terrorism, homophobia.
Absolutely. I think that that is, you know, obviously a lot more present for people who feel vulnerable. And so that comes up more often in when we're hearing from people that might be more vulnerable in those kind of situations. I think it's also really interesting, too, when you hear from people that have more privilege, you know, particular white people, upper middle class white people, when those things don't come up. I think it's also telling. So I think as a result of the show, we really try to have a real sense of trying to grab people from all over the country, all different points of view. And I think just hearing the contrast between people to me is important because it can be really telling about where people are at across the country from different political perspectives and different senses of different points of privilege and things like that, too.
That's Daniel Guimet. He is producer of the 10 Things That Scare Me podcast. Kay Powell is also with us, who did the most recent episode. Kay, what scares you about living in the world today?
I honestly can't think of anything. If I had to take one overreaching thing, it's the direction that not only this country is going, but I see happening around the world. I'll get through it, but I think about my nephews, my great niece, my great nephews. What mindset are they going to inherit in this? Are they going to grow up thinking that hate is okay, that meanness is okay, that killing is okay, that lives don't matter? That's what scares me. I have a broader perspective from the years I've lived. I've seen the good in this country and I've seen the bad. And it scares me that they may think the bad is the normal.
You say in the podcast that bullying on a lot of different scales is something that really scares you.
It does, because there seems to be this lack of concern about, but what's the root cause? That's what gets to me, is what's the root cause and what can we do to fix it? In this country, we've always liked to wait and deal with the bad result and punish. And I say get to the root cause and prevent.
That takes a lot more time.
Yes, it does.
Well, Dan, you've invited listeners to submit their own lists of things that scare them. What are some of the maybe oddest things that you've heard?
Some of the oddest ones. There was a guy that called in that I absolutely love, this guy, Luke from Kentucky. And he had these ones that I thought at first you listen to them and they seem really silly. Like he was like, oh, my hand getting caught in a conveyor belt. And you think, okay, it's, you know, sometimes people kind of have these ones that are abstracted from their life. And then he's like, oh, yeah, no, when I was younger, I had my hand caught in a conveyor belt and it was almost cut off. It was like, okay, like this is real. He had another one about, I'll be polite here, like his genitalia being exposed by accident. And then, and again, I thought, oh, he's just trying to be clever and funny. And then he explains it and it's like, oh, that happened to him when he was a kid and it was extremely embarrassing. So when he went sledding or something one time. So things like that, I found people were really real when they were calling in and leaving voicemails for us. And I were just like, incredibly, we feel so happy and grateful that people are willing to expose themselves like that and really open themselves up to us.
Do you think you're getting at people's secret selves?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. There was a woman who called and she had a great list and super interesting stuff, stuff about like some of them were really serious. Some of them were kind of, you know, funny about people in malls walking too slow and her getting really frustrated about them. But at the end of it, she revealed that she was calling us at about 1:30 in the morning. And so there's something about this, and it's something I actually try to create the show, is kind of a late night feel. Something very intimate, but also feeling like a little strange and kind of getting it, tapping into a mindset of about 3 a.m. is kind of my dream episode. And something
I'll
about
call
her calling
you. I'm
in.
Usually up then.
No problem. But something about the idea that she called in at that time, that is the time that you are kind of lying awake in bed and really thinking about the things that scare you.
Well, I want to pick up on that 3 a.m. because that's not usually our best selves, as a friend of mine says. That's when the misery parade comes marching in, you know, that sort of all the things that you didn't do, should have done, might have done come out, and the things that you're scared of. What do you think it's doing to hear other people's fears?
I don't know. I mean, Kay, can I ask you that question? Have you listened to other episodes, Kay?
It doesn't concern me. My concern would be that they listen to it and say, oh, my God, that never scared me before. But now that I think about it, it does.
I think that is definitely true sometimes. I think there's just something kind of strange and wonderful. And like we really try to get at the intimacy of a person. We're trying to make the episodes as intimate as we can. And so that you really feel like you're in someone's mind.
Yeah, I think of friends that are close to me, maybe I know some of their fears, but listing 10 is a completely different kind of thing. It frames them in a different way, lets you know them somewhat differently. Daniel, I'm wondering, have you thought about what scares you?
It's funny. I feel like by interviewing other people, it's like a way for me to not go into myself. I'm so happy that people are willing to do that for us.
So it is like therapy, except you're the therapist here.
Yeah, I think that's what I meant. And so as a result, I don't know if I have to actually go too much into myself, which is great. So it's probably that's my fear, is actually exposing myself to myself, my own fears. But, you know, I think a lot of times it's existential stuff. You know, it's being afraid of, you know, is my life going to feel meaningful? You know, am I doing the best things I can do? Am I being fair to the people around me and being, you know, treating them well? You know, I just got married recently, which is a wonderful thing. I'm so excited, you know, about it. But, you know, what's that actually going to be like in 10 years or 20 years? You know, these are things that are mixed up in my brain.
Kay, do you think a lot of the things that you talked about were about aging, projecting forward to the future? If we asked you, in 5 years, do you think you'd say the same things?
I think the same things would be at the root of what I would say, but my take on them would be very different.
Well, we'll give you a call and see if you reach into your brassiere and get your phone, and we can talk with you then.
I just got my first smartphone after about 15 years on a flip phone, and I'm doing good to answer and make phone calls.
That is Kay Pyle. She's the award-winning obituary editor and writer. She shared her biggest fears for the 10 Things That Scare Me podcast. Kay, thank you so much for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And Daniel Guimet, he's producer of the podcast. He works for WNYC Studios. Daniel, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having us on. It was so great.
And you can listen to Kay's full episode at 10thingspodcast.org. There are loads of others that you can listen to there. And we would love to know what scares you. You can go to our Facebook group, GPB Radio's On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message, if you dare, at 404-500-9457. That's our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us for On Second Thought.